AFF Jeffersonville, listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. He's emerged as a top contender for the vice presidential nod following President Joe Biden's stunning announcement that he's dropping out of the 2024 race and endorsing Kamala Harris to take his spot on the ballot. His career trajectory has seen him move from congressional aide to Pennsylvania's chief executive all within 2 decades. We'll talk to our NPR colleagues at WVIA News in Pennsylvania to learn more about this popular governor of the crucial swing state. Plus, Work Shift Live, James B. Huntington. The Monster Run is back. Monticello Rotary's Laurie Estrano James speaks to us this morning, and author A.J. Shankman's new book for children, Franklin's Trees. Culture reporter Valerie Banzi has more. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden is calling for major reforms of the U.S. Supreme Court, including limits for justices. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Biden plans to unveil his proposed reforms at an event at the LBJ Library in Texas, commemorating the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights. In an op-ed in the Washington Post, call for a constitutional amendment that makes it clear no one is immune from prosecution for crimes committed while in office. If implemented, it would reverse the recent Supreme Court decision giving presidents almost total immunity. He also calls for 8-year term limits so that each president would nominate a justice every 2 years. And he wants a binding code of conduct for Supreme Court justices, just like the code that applies to other federal judges. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
California fire officials say the Park Fire has now burned 575 square miles. It is the largest active blaze burning in the U.S., and it's larger than Los Angeles. More than 100 structures have been destroyed. The Park Fire is still out of control because it's only 12% contained. Craig Kelbutt says he is sure that firefighters will be able to put his home.
I'm pretty confident talking to this here. They're doing a lot of work, a lot of hand line, a lot of hand crew around here. They're pretty confident. Everything's going to be safe.
Police in Butte County have detained a man suspected of starting the Park Fire. He'll appear in a California courtroom later today. Election officials in Venezuela are claiming that incumbent President Nicolas Maduro has won a third term in office. With the majority of the ballots counted from yesterday's election, they say Maduro beat the opposition candidate 51% to 44%. The Venezuelan opposition is not buying that. They say their candidate won in a landslide. In a highly anticipated men's tennis match at the Olympics, top-seeded Novak Djokovic has defeated 14-time French Open winner Rafael Nadal. The final was 6-1, 6-4. Stocks opened higher today on Wall Street as investors anticipate a Fed update on interest rates this week. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the Dow Jones Industrials were up 24 points.
All eyes are on the Federal Reserve after some strong economic reports last week. The Fed is meeting Tuesday and Wednesday. Most economists don't expect it to start lowering interest rates immediately, but they are watching for more signals that a rate cut is coming in September. Meanwhile, Bitcoin prices are continuing to rise after former President Donald Trump spoke at a crypto conference over the weekend and promised investors he would turn the United States into the crypto capital of the planet. Trump previously called crypto a scam and a disaster waiting to happen. But on Saturday, he promised to create a national Bitcoin stockpile if elected to another presidency.
NPR's Maria Aspen. It's NPR. Deep concern remains about whether a wider war will break out in the Middle East. Over the weekend, a rocket fired from Lebanon hit the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. 12 children were killed. Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, claims it did not fire the rocket, but Israel says Hezbollah is responsible. Iran says a strong Israeli reaction will lead to unprecedented consequences. Scientists say the drying Great Salt Lake in Utah is now becoming a significant contributor to global greenhouse gas emissions. These are causing the climate to warm. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports on a new study from Colorado State University published in the journal One Earth.
Due largely to water diversions by farmers and Utah's booming population growth, the Great Salt Lake has shrunk by almost half in recent years. Scientists spent 7 months in 2020 sampling emissions coming off the dried saline lake bed. They found that it emitted roughly 4 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, which would translate to a 7% increase in Utah's human-caused emissions. Scientists say 4 million tons of CO2 is roughly the equivalent of the total annual emissions of 140 commercial planes. The study occurred during one of the most notorious dry stretches of the West's 20-year mega drought. The Great Salt Lake's levels have rebounded slightly lately due to the last two snowy winters. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
The American Meteor Society says two meteor showers will peak this week. The Meteor Society says a good time to watch for them in North America is just before dawn. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris vets potential vice presidential running mates, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro shows up near the top of most lists. Roger Dupuy at WVIA News, our NPR colleagues in Luzerne County, reported on what a Harris-Shapiro ticket could mean for the governor, his state, and the party. And Roger joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Well, good. Thanks for being here. And Governor Shapiro, a pretty popular governor, I see.
He is. And, you know, at a time when everyone is sort of struggling with favorability ratings, I think there was a new poll that came out on Friday, which said that he was at 61%, which dwarfs, you know, everyone else in the race, including, you know, the people on the top of the ticket. So he's well liked in this state. As you know, he won by about 14 points and change in 2022 against Doug Mastriano. And he is seen by a lot of folks as a potential key to helping Harris carry Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Politico was reporting on an endorsement event that took place in Philadelphia on Friday, and their headline is, Philly's Kamala Harris endorsement event becomes a Josh Shapiro for VP party. Lots of folks, union leaders and other officials, taking turns to endorse him as her pick. Can you remind folks a little bit, you mentioned a little bit, you know, that he came into power a few years ago. Can you talk more about his rise to prominence?
Right. So, I mean, as I pointed out in my story, Josh Shapiro has never lost an election. And actually, there's a piece that I didn't even mention going back to his college days. I think when he ran for class president, he didn't lose. He started in politics in Montgomery County outside of Philadelphia, ran for state rep and was elected to several terms at that. And I think he was first elected at 31, went from there back to the Montgomery County commissioners where he served for a number of terms. Then he becomes the state's attorney general. And then 2022 runs for governor and wins by, you know, by Pennsylvania standards, what was a landslide. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's been involved in politics at the municipal, well, at the county level, at the state level, as a rep in his region. And of course, as you know, that Montgomery County is one of those critical collar counties around Philadelphia where, you know, there are many suburban voters are eagerly courted by the national campaigns. So, you know, he's really in a unique position to bring, you know, a large constituency to the fore if he were selected.
He successfully ran for Pennsylvania Attorney General in 2016, won re-election in 2020. And you mentioned one of the hallmarks of his tenure as Attorney General was the handling of this investigation into decades of sexual abuse within the Roman Catholic Church across Pennsylvania. Can you talk a little bit more about how he handled that?
Yeah, absolutely. I was in newspapers for most of my career. I was at the Times Leader in Wilkes-Barre at the time. And we covered that. I mean, I was in a room full of Roman Catholics, right? And, folks who were both covering the story and also feeling very, you know, very disappointed in what had happened. But to a person, I think everyone sort of felt, at least in our newsroom and many of the folks we talked to in the community at the time, that it had to come out. It had to be done. And because Governor Shapiro is Jewish, one of the things that a lot of folks feel, and former Governor Ed Rendell said this to me the other day, not everybody would have felt as confident in taking on the Roman Catholic Church as he did, right? Which is not to say that it was any kind of an attack, but it needed to be done. And even in the report that came out about all this abuse, which spanned decades, you know, there were police officers and community officials who saw, you know, saw things, reported things, and then kind of let them fall by the wayside, because of course nobody wants to challenge the church, but Josh Shapiro did, you know, impaneled a jury, which compiled this really, really frightening report about the abuse which had taken place. And I think that was a landmark. He also was very big in going after the opioid companies, right? Because, I mean, they are driving, you know, the crisis in the country and certainly here in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, he was never afraid to take on big entities that that other prosecutors might have shied away from, I think.
You mentioned his religion. He's a practicing Jew. How could that factor into the meaningful votes for some voters, and how does that impact how he governs?
Right. You know, in terms of how he governs, I would say it doesn't. I mean, I think, you know, from what everyone says is he's a, you know, a good family man who is observant of his religion, and as far as that goes. But in terms of politics, I think what's very, very interesting is that it could sort of cut both ways, right? I mean, on the right, there are a lot of moderates, both Democrats and Republicans, who have looked at some of the things that have happened in the United States over the last 8 or 9 months and said, look, anti-Semitism is on the rise. This is frightening. This is wrong. Someone needs to speak out. And Josh Shapiro did, right? So for moderate Republicans who might be, or independents who are potentially looking to move away from the Republican Party, but who are concerned about Israel, concerned about anti-Semitism, Josh Shapiro is somebody that they might look at as a favorable candidate. On the other hand, you have folks on the left of the Democratic Party who are very pro-Gaza. His stance on Gaza, his, you know, his opposition to some of the protesters, really, and what they were saying in the Philadelphia area earlier this year, that might not sit well with them. But I think the larger constituency we need to look at is the moderates, who Kamala Harris needs to bring on board if she is going to win. And I think, you know, Governor Shapiro's religion certainly would be helpful in that regard.
You mentioned some of the issues that are, you know, surrounding the Gaza situation, but also there are other issues that are coming up as the spotlight focuses on him, his push for school vouchers, his environmental record, other issues. Do you think these things are just, I mean, these are part of the process, but is there anything meaningful there that could derail his rise as a favored pick?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So as I was getting ready for the interview, I was looking at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they had an interesting story this morning about why Josh's potential nominee, you know, choice as nominee, is making the GOP nervous, mm-hmm. right? Because he has, and he will tell you this, he has passed a budget in a divided legislature, right? I mean, so he's had to govern in a state where, you know, Republicans, Democrats are fiercely divided, managed to pass a budget late, but I think a lot earlier than many of his predecessors had done. And one of the ways he did that was to make compromises, such as on school vouchers, which is an issue which I know is very dear to many on the left and also on the right. And so he is not afraid to cross boundaries. It, you know, the paradox of Josh Shapiro is that even as he is a consensus candidate, he by being so, you know, potentially he could alienate some on the left. And there's a lot of concern about younger voters, younger left-leaning voters, and where they stand in all this. But I think the group that everyone's really after is sort of, you know, the suburban moderate, right? And those are the folks that I think would be drawn in by a candidate who can govern through consensus and who is looking to build bridges as opposed to, you know, continue engaging in culture war fights. And that's just generally not been his approach, if that makes sense.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Roger Dupuis at WVIA News, our NPR colleagues in Pennsylvania, about Governor Josh Shapiro and how he is at the top of many lists for vice presidential pick for now presumptive Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. You know, the other thing is, we mentioned, and I think we all know, Pennsylvania, a crucial swing state. You spoke to Todd Zimmerman, who is chair of the Schuylkill County Democratic Party, and he's also a DNC delegate, and he mentions, you know, they need Pennsylvania, and he also points out something you alluded to that makes the GOP nervous, is that Shapiro defeated their sort of hard right candidate Mastriano 2 years ago.
He sure did, and you know, and Mastriano was, and I don't think he would dispute the label of Christian nationalist, right?
Yeah.
This is someone who was. Very far to the right, talking about no exceptions for rape or incest when we're dealing with abortion. And Josh defeated him handily. And speaking from my region, right? So, you know, we are based in Luzerne County, and Luzerne County was carried by Donald Trump twice in 2016 and 2020. But despite that, Josh Shapiro managed to win Luzerne County in 2022. You know, when Mastriano was such a popular candidate with many on the far right. So, I mean, he's proven, I think, that he not only can, as I say, build bridges, but he's not afraid to take on that sort of extremism. And that is precisely one of the battles that Kamala Harris is going to need to fight, as I think, you know, as you said, Zimmerman alluded to.
You also mentioned that he's built clout as a GSD governor. Can you explain what that means?
I don't even know if I'm allowed to say that.
I don't know if you can say all of it, but...
Yeah, right. As he says in polite company, get stuff done. When the I-95 bridge collapsed after a fiery crash last year in Philadelphia, I mean, I think under his leadership and working with PennDOT, the bridge was reconstructed in 12 days. And as you probably know, that is a vital link for the entire Northeast, and it absolutely had to be fixed. And he got it done, as he said, got stuff done. And that kind of became his mantra, right? I mean, think Josh is sort of a no-nonsense, you know, straightforward kind of guy. I mean, he's a prosecutor, right? And he built his reputation on being both methodical and thorough, but also getting to the heart of a matter quickly. And that was certainly what happened in Philadelphia. Not everyone loves the phrase, you know, and in my story, I think, you know, there was a quote from the Commonwealth Foundation who kind of pointed out that profanity and all, you know, this is who Shapiro is. And I guess for people who are offended by the brown word, yeah, that might be a problem. But for folks who are looking for good governance and cutting through bureaucracy, I mean, he's trying to develop that reputation. You know, it's sort of, if I can call him this, the Pete Buttigieg of Pennsylvania, right? I mean, when it comes to infrastructure and those sorts of issues, I mean, he's taken a very hands-on approach.
We're having just a little trouble on your line there. Just letting folks know it's the line here we have, not the radio. But you know, you mentioned also he's a very astute strategist. So what do you think he could bring to the ticket?
Right. It's all of Pennsylvania. You know, I think, you know, courting this state is going to be so vital. Remember the blue wall from 2020 of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. They cannot afford to lose the state. And before Harris took over, look, the polls were strongly suggesting that Joe Biden was in trouble. Recent polls suggest that now Kamala has pulled even, right? With Donald Trump, it's a lot closer, but I don't think they can afford to take any risks. And with a popular, recently elected governor in this state who has a great deal of name recognition, the feeling is that if they want to deliver Pennsylvania, he would be it. Now, I think a lot of folks traditionally have sort of felt that the VP candidate doesn't necessarily bring a lot to the ticket. You know, you don't always, it's more about balance than it is about geography, but I think this is going to be a different kind of election than we've seen in the past, right? Yeah. I think in worst case scenario, the VP can lose you votes, and there are a lot of folks who are questioning whether or not J.D. Vance is going to do that for Trump, but the geography matters more this time than it ever did. And remember, Joe Biden was you know, despite the fact that he had grown up in Delaware, was born and raised in Scranton in his earlier years and had a strong affinity for Pennsylvania. And so, you know, that was something of a loss, I think, right? Kamala Harris is from California. She doesn't have the ties to Pennsylvania. So you do want someone on the ticket who has, you know, some strong connection to the state, and Shapiro fits that bill.
He was even whispered as a possible 2028 presidential contender.
Yes. And to go back to one of the things you asked me before, you know, what are some of the pluses and minuses? Shapiro very much wants to win, right? I mean, he wanted to win for Joe Biden. He was acting as a surrogate as, you know, as early as last September out on the trail. And they were talking about him as a 2028 candidate then. So you do have to wonder in his mind whether or not joining the ticket at this point makes it more or less likely that he will someday be able to run in his own right at the top. And I mean, listen, I'm just a reporter here in Pennsylvania, but I have to wonder if joining in 2024 means he's out of it for 2020. Right? I mean, because presumably if Harris does well and Harris decides to seek re-election in 2028, obviously he's not likely to challenge, you know, the head of his party. At least that's the perspective that I would put on it, you know, sitting here in 2024. So, you know, maybe in his mind, this is a bad move personally, but the question is whether or not he feels it's a good move for the country. And if he can be convinced of that, and if Vice President Harris sees him as the person to choose, I have no doubt he would go along with it. But as you know, so far, he's not saying a word. He's merely, you know, drumming up support for Harris and touring the state to do that and not saying a word about what his own intentions are, other than he would be honored to serve if chosen. But that doesn't tell us much.
Well, and in fact, today he's campaigning outside Philadelphia with another person on that short list, Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan. So he's not saying much. But you did check with the odds folks. The gambling world is weighing in. Where have they put him as terms of favorites of being picked?
You know, let's look, because as of last week when I did that, when I wrote that story initially, he was number two. He was behind Kelly. But you know what? Just click the link quick and see what they're saying. I looked at oddschecker.com, which was one of those aggregate sites. Ah, I stand corrected. Well, he was number two at the time, but as of this morning, he is number one.
Wow.
He is the favorite ahead of Kelly. Substantially. Well, I'm going to be honest, I'm not much of a gambler. It's got him up plus 156, Kelly plus 225, and then Walls, it drops off precipitously. Walls 720, Cooper, Beshear, Buttigieg. So, I mean, yeah, he's the favorite by a long shot, it appears.
We'll find out very soon. It's whispered that Kamala Harris will be picking her VP candidate by August 7th.
August 7th, yeah.
That's Roger Dupuy from WVIA News. Thank you so much, Roger. I'm sure we'll be checking in with you again as this really interesting election unfolds.
Absolutely. Tim, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, James B. Huntington with Work Shift Live. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Monday, and we check in with Mr. James B. Huntington for some local economic perspective. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
All right, getting started on a Monday with a check-in on inflation last month. What can you tell us?
Well, the personal consumption expenditures index came out last week. It is the Fed's preferred inflation measure. It went up 2.5% annually, which is a notch down from the 2.6 in the previous month. This reflects June's data. It reflects everything. When they take out food and fuel costs, it turns out to be 2.6%, a little different. There's not a great deal of difference in how food and fuel are going up in relation to other things right now, relatively calm times. So that looks good. It seems more likely that when the Fed meets the next time in September on the 18th, that they will lower interest rates. It seems likely at this point, although it probably will not be a large amount, maybe just a quarter point, but something. Inflation is going down. It is getting less significant, and that is good news for bringing interest rates down.
All right. So what about economic growth in the second quarter?
Yes. News on that. The gross domestic product went up at a 2.8% annual rate. in the second quarter, looking over the last 15 years, that's really around average. It's still quite healthy for a country as economically mature and as huge as the U.S. is, that we're still going up close to 3% per year. There's no reason, the population is not going up that much, so there's no real reason why it has to do that. We should be happy with it. So otherwise, one commentator said the economy is in a transition, but it's in a good place. Some things are changing. A little more fear of recession, although those are still really unjustified. If you look at all the other data, recession is really a long way. Maybe moving to sort of neutral times as far as employment and such goes, but it's nothing like that. So the bad news is there are signs that some families, especially ones with low or moderate incomes, are struggling, as because they may see it that prices are high, insurance costs are high, and financing anything, a house or a car especially, is going to be expensive because of the higher interest rates. So there are causes for concerns. It's not perfect, but it's good that the economy is still growing, because that tends to mean more prosperity.
What is a surveillance pricing? You have a story about that and why it's controversial.
Oh, boy. This is...
I don't like the sound of it, I have to tell you. Surveillance? Are somebody watching me?
No. Yes.
Wow.
Absolutely. Yes, they are. They're not watching your body or whatever, but they're picking up on your demographics, your credit history, your browsing and shopping history, and using those things to set a targeted price for products or services. It's starting to happen. There are 8 companies that are providing this. The FTC, Federal Trade Commission, is looking into that. They've officially launched a probe. I don't think this will end well for the people who are providing this data. It wouldn't surprise me if it were banned entirely. But pricing target prices for individual consumers, that's, if you want to find a way of making people very angry, tell them that when they get online and look for a price on something, it may be different from what someone else gets. And that's not a way of keeping people happy. Mm. So Amazon has already been guilty of this to some extent in the past. Their prices change all the time. And the extent to which they're doing it, I don't know if that's ever been revealed, but this is a real cause for concern, because there is a great capability of getting these things, tying data together about people and attaching that to your ID or your password or your profile on different sites, and knowing that they can do this sort of thing. I don't think we know really the extent of it, how much is actually happening right now, but the capability, I assure you, is strongly there. And as someone, the FTC chair, called it, a shadowy ecosystem of pricing middlemen. Doesn't sound like they're going to get a great break when it's established firmly that they're doing it.
Yeah, doesn't sound good at all. Let's talk about something a little better. Best states to retire to, and also some of the worst states. What can you tell us?
Okay, this is a survey from Bankrate. And they have used their algorithm. We've seen things like this before, and it really depends on what factors they put in. And for you and me and everyone else, it's going to depend on what ones are personally important for us. This one is supposed to be living costs, health care costs, crime rates, and something they call overall well-being, which sounds sort of suspect to me, and I wonder if they're handling the data properly. But anyway, the best states in order came out as Delaware number one because of high quality health care, light taxes, and relatively cheap homeowners insurance along with good weather. Second is West Virginia, mainly because it's affordable. It's apparently quite cheap to live there now, but they did note that quality and cost of health care are the absolute worst among the 50 in West Virginia. Georgia, 15th last year, now third this year, much more affordable in general. Fourth, South Carolina. They liked the weather and they liked the improvement on crime, and health care is relatively cheap there. And fifth is Missouri. General affordability and property taxes. Property taxes were a strong thing here, so they have some things not great, but it turned out very good. And the worst from bottom to top is Alaska, mainly for how expensive it is, and crime. I guess crime is getting to be a problem in Anchorage more. Second worst is, guess what? New York.
Oh, no.
Yes, they got a bit. The tax reputation in general and the cost of living, although, I mean, New York is really has multiple areas that are different. There's the, oftentimes New York City can really dominate the data in something like this, even though there are areas, of course, that are very different. So I would take that with a grain of salt. Third worst is Washington. Fourth worst is California. It's just expensive as anything, a lot of things. And fifth is North Dakota. I would guess that's a lot about the weather.
Well, yeah, and those factors that you know, you see these surveys all over, as you mentioned, it's how they sort of determine it with this one. You know, to make sure we get everything in here, I want to get to the numbers quickly. How are the numbers this morning, and how did they change?
Yes, now these numbers are later this morning than I usually pull them, so, but they are some time ago. So what I have here is gold at $23.93, down $8, sort of treading water more than anything else. Silver, $27.90, down $1.15. Surprising, the ratio is 86 to 1, and if you play around with these things, it looks like silver is the buy here. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 40,549, up 261, very similar to last week's gain. It seems to be heading toward 41,000. Not so good for NASDAQ, 17,486, down 241. We still have artificial intelligence stock problems and a lot of concern, a lot more press about whether AI is making any money. A lot of them have, the stock prices have been really bloated. And as I mentioned before, there are some advisors are suggesting you dump them. So that's really pulling the NASDAQ down all by itself. There's such a big influence now. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 77.12, down 3.28. I think we can expect lower prices to reach the pump soon, probably this week. Bitcoin, 68,962. That's up 1882. That's after last week's 4,000 gain. So it's really seems to be going up, and it's not too far from its all-time high now. Pound, $1.2833. That's down 85 hundredths of a cent. The euro, 1.0818, down 76 hundredths of a cent. Both of those are weakening, and the U.S. interest rates are just sitting there at 5.3% minimum. So they're good places for people to buy or put their money instead of in the pound and euro as I see it. But the Japanese 100 yen coin, 65 cents, is up a penny, up yet again. Maybe it's going to go back to eventually to the dollar for 100 yen it was at for so long. So they're making moves. They're trying hard. They have more inflation in Japan now, but and it seems to be increasing the value of their currency. So overall, we had the good areas are the Dow, the Bitcoin, and the yen. Gold and silver are, they may activate. I would not be surprised to see silver go up and gold go up a little bit anyway over the next few weeks.
All right. Well, thanks for running the numbers for us. That is a local economist and author, James B. Huntington, joins us every Monday with a look at the economy from a local economic perspective. Thank you very much, James B.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Monticello Rotary Club's annual Monster Run Classic. It's coming up this weekend. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to wjffradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Monticello Rotary Club's 46th annual Monster Run Classic is this Sunday at Resorts World Catskills in Monticello. Proceeds from the 2024 Monster Classic race will benefit the Sullivan County Veterans Coalition. Joining us now is president of the Monticello Rotary, Lori Oristano. James, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good to see you.
It's great to see you. I always love coming into studio.
Thank you for coming in. And tell us about this, the 46th annual Monster Run.
The 46th annual, yeah. We are one of the longest, if not the longest, race in the county.
And tell folks about the Monster Run if they don't know about it after 46 years.
So the Monster Run was originally on the original Monster Golf Course.
Yeah.
It was all along that road, and it got named that because it was along the Monster Golf Course, but we had this huge hill they had to climb, and it was a Monster Hill. And that's how it originally got named. And 46 years ago, we started really just doing it to help benefit all projects that we were doing. And then a couple years in, we started actually bringing in partner agencies so that way we could do benefits. And then a number of years ago, we switched it over. Well, we'd been on Broadway for a while once the Concord had been demolished and things of that nature. And you couldn't get onto the golf course. And now the golf course is back, you know, with Resorts World and everything else. So we moved back from Lower Broadway and moved back onto the golf course. The course is beautiful. I don't know if anyone's ever been along those trails that are there in that area, but it's a beautiful, beautiful run or walk. So it's a 5K walk, 5K run, or a 10K run.
So you could do any one of these things.
Any one of those combinations.
And anybody from any age can do it.
Any age group. We have people from as young as, you know, 5-6-year-olds that are participating with some of their parents, up to and through octogenarians.
Mm-hmm.
We have some people in their 80s, and they've been coming to us for years and doing this event, and it's really wonderful to see everybody participate. And of course, we're doing it for a great cause, you know, for the Sullivan County Veterans Coalition. People don't realize our veterans, they're in need of a lot of things in our area that are not necessarily covered, especially with concerns of inflation costs and they're on fixed incomes, and trying to make those ends meet are sometimes difficult. So whether it's helping to pay for transportation to get them to VA hospitals, whether it's helping to pay for energy in their homes so that they have heat and electric, things of that nature, and sometimes even just food. But we work beautifully for the past number of years with Howie Goldsmith, and it's been a really great coordination and collaboration of things that we need in our community.
Do you have some vets participating in the run?
We do. We have vets that participate in the run, and we have vets that volunteer. And volunteerism, by the way, you can come and volunteer for this. We need people who can help give out water at the water stations. We need people who can help to monitor and help us give out the T-shirts and things like that when we're doing the registrations. There's plenty of volunteer stuff that is available. And if you are interested, you can just go to rotarymonty@gmail.com and just give us your contact information, and someone will be in touch with you to see what it is that you're interested in volunteering and helping us with. We need to be able to give directions, because, it's almost like the Scarecrow and the Wizard of Oz, the two hands go in the different direction and you're not sure which direction someone's supposed to go. And when you're running, you need someone to tell you.
Yeah. And one of the major goals of Rotary, of course, is serving the community. And you're doing that with this run, but right. You're also doing it with many other things, including blood drives.
So correct. So we do 5 blood drives a year. We focus 2 of them around events, one around the Heartathon that we participate in, and we also do one around the Monster Run. So for people who aren't aware, you can donate blood every 57 days or more. So we are at the 57-day mark. That's why we have the five that are laid out. Blood shortage is very real. And, sometimes people don't realize until you or a family member or a loved one needs blood, you don't realize how important it is for us to give blood. I became very passionate about blood drives when I had to stop giving blood because I'm a cancer survivor, so they will not take my blood anymore. But my sister has a condition called von Willebrand's disease, which is basically female hemophilia, and she needs 17 donors every 3 months so she can get the platelets that she needs in order to get what she needs to survive.
Wow.
And that's what it takes. And it's really important that we realize how important that connection of giving blood is. So on Saturday, August 3rd, there are 2 things that you can do. You can come and register for the Monster Run at Resorts World Catskills in the Epicenter. So you can come and actually register for the race that day. You can pick up your bib as well if you've already pre-registered, so you don't have to stand on lines on Sunday morning. So you can come and get that on Saturday morning during the blood drive. And you can come to the blood drive and give blood. And giving blood is very, very simple. And just so everyone knows, every pint that you give saves 3 lives. So they take a pint of blood out of you. It takes about 24 hours for it to come back into your system fully. You give the blood. And when you give your blood for this, we're running a pint for pint campaign. So you give us a pint of blood, and we're going to give you a coupon to get a craft ale at a Resorts World. There's some other places that are also offering, so there'll be plenty of names on the coupon. But we encourage you to utilize Resorts World Catskills because they are so generous to us.
Well, before we go, let's remind folks where they can get this information. Great to have these 2 things back to back, so you can take care of 2 birds, 1 stone kind of thing.
So very simply, you can go to our Facebook page, which is Monticello Rotary New York. You want to make sure you're doing New York and not on the Indiana page, because there's a Monticello Rotary in Indiana. So you can go to the Facebook page, or you can go to our website, which is the same thing. If you just Google Monticello Rotary, Monticello New York, you're going to come up on our page. And very simply, just we're like the first hit once you do that. And just go in. You can see our stories. You can see the links. You can see information on how to contact us. And there's a phone number there should you want to, speak to a human voice.
That's Lori Aristano-James from the Monticello Rotary, doing great work serving the community. Thank you so much. I know we'll be in touch as you continue to do more great things around this fall, too.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. All right. We are going to talk to A.J. Schenkman now, the author of several books about local and regional history. He's written for many magazines, blogs, journals, including articles about Hudson Valley history in Ulster Magazine, the Times Herald Record, Chronogram, and on his website, Ulster County History Journal. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to him about his latest book, Franklin's Trees.
Good morning, A.J., and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So I see you have yet another book on history out. You are a very busy, busy, busy history writer with interesting angles on history. And this book really intrigued me because it is for young adults. Am I correct?
Correct. It's, I believe, from 5 to 10 years old.
Oh, okay. So it's a children's book, really.
Correct.
Okay, and it's Franklin's Trees. Tell us about Franklin's Trees and what drew you to this topic for children.
Well, what drew me to the topic is, since I was a little boy, I visited FDR's Presidential Library and Museum, and what was really kind of the park rangers really kind of drilled into my head is his love for trees. And there were even some witness trees that are still around on the property. And I was always wanted to write something to honor Eleanor and Franklin. And I started working on a book about their dog, Fala.
Uh-huh.
And I was getting really frustrated about it. And then one morning I was taking a shower, and then all of a sudden the whole view came to me, and I just, jumped out of the shower and began dictating this whole children's book right into my iPhone. And it's what's before you. And the idea is that Franklin has such a love of trees, and his favorite tree was a tulip poplar. And when he was stricken down with polio, one of the reasons that he struggled and wanted to walk so badly is he wanted to see his trees again. And in fact, his long driveway is lined by these beautiful maples. And, and I would like to think that they gave him strength to move forward.
Wonderful. And what exactly is the focus for the children?
The focus is love of nature and the love of trees and just seeing Franklin Delano Roosevelt from another angle. A boy who grew up around this nature and appreciated it and also was one of the early conservationists. He didn't refer to himself as the president. He didn't refer to himself as the governor. He didn't refer to himself as a state senator. He referred to himself as a tree farmer. And he had, state forestry down there, always helping him to better his, his tree plantation.
And did he initiate Civil Conservation Corps? What was the name of it?
Well, the CCC. Which, was one of them, the Civilian Conservation Corps. And that was part of what, us social studies teachers called, FDR's alphabet soup. But also a lot of the stuff he preserved, too, was local history. I mean, he's just such an amazing individual. And what the federal government just did such a great job with that site that when you're walking around the site, you just expect him to just pop out and say hi.
I'm embarrassed to say I have never been there. And now I am after reading about you in the book, I'm definitely on my to-do list.
And if you're going to visit that, another part of the estate is Valk Hill, which is, of course, is Eleanor Roosevelt's cottage. And, my son refers to that part as his happy place.
Oh.
And we spent a lot of time on that estate, during, I guess they call it now, the lockdown during COVID. I mean, that was our place to kind of just unwind and walk our dog. And our dog even was made a bark ranger, which was kind of cool.
Oh, wow. So what a beautiful story.
And I wanted to just give back to that site. And
yes.
In fact, they will be carrying my book in the gift shop.
Wonderful.
And July 12th from 1 to 4, I'll be signing books there.
And that is in Hyde Park?
That's Hyde Park, and that's the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Library and Museum, and also in Hyde Park on July 20th from, I think it's 11 to 12, I'll be at the Hyde Park Library. And I'll be doing a book reading, book signing, and all those great things.
Well, you're no stranger to book readings and book signings and blogs and radio appearances and TV appearances.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And I was even, I guess 2 years ago now, I hope I'm again, I was voted best author of the Hudson Valley by Hudson Valley Magazine.
Well, that's not a surprise, and I wanted to get to that so our listeners would, in case they don't know about you, would learn about some of the books you've written about the Hudson Valley that really have a very interesting twist.
Well, what they can do is my website is ajshankman.com, and my blog is History Made Seamless. And believe it or not, now I'm on TikTok at author AJ.
Wow, nothing keeps you down, AJ.
No, I like to keep busy. And now, you know, my young son is, you know, he's starting to get into the whole technology, so he's able to, you know, we're working on YouTube videos now. Called History Made Seamless, and we have a little animated figure that talks to you and walks through the houses, through history and all that.
Wonderful. Now, tell us a little bit about your blog.
It's just taking complex topics and kind of whittling them down to make them understandable. In my book, Unexpected Bravery, which is a Civil War book about women and children that served in the Civil War, including women who dressed as men to serve in the Civil War. And one of the reviewers said that one thing about your reading that I appreciate is it doesn't read like a textbook. I give you just enough to understand the person and the times that they lived in, and not to bore you. And that's kind of what History Made Seamless is. And I also like writing about people who maybe their only testament to life is a headstone or an obituary, and just, you know, reconstructing their lives and giving the voiceless voices. That makes sense.
Oh, yes, yes. You've also written about a number of notorious Hudson Valley residents in Wicked Ulster and Murder and Mayhem.
Yes, yes, yes. That and you know, and I'm a teacher, and you know, I'm a social studies teacher, and my students are they're my inspiration. You know, just through their questions, like for instance, Unexpected Bravery. You know, were there any women that served in the war? And then, you know, you start and you do your research and you do your research, you know, and you're always trying to stay one, you know, step ahead of them. And I would say also that I had to do an in-service. It might have been at the Dorsky Museum in New Paltz. And I like telling stories about local history. And at that time, I had a whole, like, house full of animals. And no, and they'd wake me up early in the morning, and you know, and so what I would do is I would just look through old newspapers and read old books while I was waiting for my dog to finish chewing on her bone after I fed her, and then, you know, and then we'd go for a walk. So I would tell these stories. So I think it might have been the director of the Dorsky Museum said, you know, these are such great stories. Why don't you write a book about it, like Gangs of Ulster County?
Oh, yes.
So that's kind of the way it happened. And if I hadn't been sent by my district on this in-service, I don't think that book would have really happened. It was just someone putting an idea in my head.
And you run with it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, one of the many things I learned, but with Wicked Ulster, was it used to be called Ulster County?
Yeah.
U-L-C-E-R?
Yes. Yep. I forgot the quote offhand, but it's, you know, basically, you know, the New York Herald maybe said that it was just, you know, riddled with crime. And ghosts, and if there was something evil going on, you were sure it was happening up there, and they named the county Ulster County. I always would get this question, you know, how do people feel about you writing about them like this and writing about their ancestors?
Right.
And I have a quote, I think, in the second book that said, you know, basically, if you know, people wanted to be remembered better. You know, they should have behaved better.
Well, I like that. Absolutely. That's it.
That's still my best-selling book.
Oh, it's great. And I read Murder and Mayhem, too, which is
God. And that's the second best-selling book. And I keep an eye on my stats and all that, unfortunately. Uh-huh. And Wicked Ulster especially is always on Amazon anyway, is always dipping down to like 20,000 out of like what, 5 million books. In fact, Franklin's Trees, for about a week or so before it was even released, was a number one book in Amazon. In I think presidential biographies and first ladies section.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
So we're hoping this book is going to do well. And in fact, I think it's a good angle for on FDR that most people probably don't know about him.
Well, because he did so much.
He did so much.
Well, is there anything else you would like to add? And please repeat your website again so folks can look up the books you've written as well as the many articles, because they're really good reads from my standpoint.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. My website is ajshankman.com. That's ajshankman.com. And you can click to go to the blog from there, but my blog is History Made Seamless. And on TikTok, I'm at Author AJ.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you so much for writing these wonderful books and writing in a way that's interesting and fun. And I thank you for your role as an educator.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And it's, you know, I hit 30 years already.
Wow.
I did 25 or 26 in public school and, you know, in 5 years and, you know, everything from the Archdiocese to Dutchess County BOCES. And, you know, and it still is as fun as it was when I was a first year teacher and with no idea of leaving or retiring. I mean, the ways kids see history, a lot of times it's just a very fresh perspective, even if it's just a question of, you know, what was Franklin's favorite tree or something like that. And a lot of times, you know, I have another book that'll be coming out next year with a different publisher. And it's about Hispanic Americans in the Civil War. I mean, you don't realize that, Admiral Farragut, he's the first admiral in United States naval history, and he's Hispanic. You know, he was from Menorca, if I'm pronouncing that right, Spain, just a lot of interesting individuals. And a lot of times we don't focus on all the diversity in the Civil War, and also that it was not just a civil war between, you know, North and South, but even different groups like Native Americans and, you know, and Hispanic Americans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's so I'm writing from that perspective, too. And that'll be out in 2025.
Thank you again for your work. And thank you for taking the time to share it with us.
Thank you for having me on. I love WJFF.
Good. We like to hear that.
All right.
We do. That was a culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to author and historian AJ Shankman. Before we go, we have reports of a missing dog in Roscoe, a 60-pound black pit lab mix named Bruce with white markings on his chest and a green collar, last seen yesterday, 10:15 in the morning on Gulf Road in Roscoe, going toward Tanana Lake Road. Call us here at the station. We'll put you in touch with the owner if you have any sightings of Bruce, the missing 60-pound black pit lab mix. We hope we find Bruce quick. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania.
Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill. Listen to us on your smart speaker. Just ask your smart speaker to play WJFF Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill. Today's weather, a thunderstorm in spots this afternoon, a high 79. Cloudy tonight with a low of 63. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.